The suspect in the Waffle House massacre in Tennessee was not allowed to own an assault rifle nearby in Illinois, but
it seems he may be allowed to legally own those guns in Tennessee, even though he wasn't able to own them in Illinois.
Gun laws and loopholes, do the rules we have to keep guns from dangerous people even work? Also, yesterday we heard from Randy Bryce, known as Iron Stash, on his bid to replace Paul Ryan in Wisconsin. Today, his opponent in the Democratic primary, schoolteacher Kathy Myers.
I believe that the voice of women is not being heard, and that's one of the reasons why I am running.
And actress Laurie Metcalf on returning to her role on a newly controversial Roseanne.
They took a giant issue of the election and then ended up, like they used to back in the day, of boiling it down to making it still about the family.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, April 24th, 2018. Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On Monday, police in Nashville, Tennessee, apprehended the man suspected of killing four people and wounding four others in a Waffle House restaurant. Witnesses say Travis Reinking walked up to the Murfreesboro Pike Waffle House in Antioch, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville, early on Sunday morning and started firing. When he tried to reload, a customer named James Shaw Jr. jumped up and wrestled the AR-15 assault rifle out of Travis Reinking's hands, and then Reinking fled into the dark. That kicked off a manhunt for Travis Reinking that lasted 34 hours. And as more of his backstory is revealed now, more questions arise about his access to weapons. We'll come back to that in just a moment. But first, let's go to Dave Boucher. He's investigative reporter for The Tennessean, who joins me now from Nashville. Dave, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Well, Dave, bring us up to date on the latest on Travis Reinking's apprehension. How was he caught? What happened yesterday?
So yesterday afternoon at roughly 1 p.m. Central Time Monday, a call came in from a construction crew that was working in the vicinity of the Waffle House where the attack actually occurred early Sunday. A call came in. Someone said that they saw a man who looked like he was a little bit confused and nervous. Police arrived within minutes of the call. They entered into a wooded area near the construction site. And a detective saw a man who met Reinking's description. They told him to lay down, extend his hands, and they arrested him.
And you mentioned this was close to the Waffle House where the shooting occurred over the weekend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the manhunt lasted 34 hours, but he was actually captured less than 2 miles away from where it started. Keep in mind that for almost all of that 34 hours, there were canine units and helicopters and law enforcement from local, state, and national agencies kind of scouring the area, looking for a man who had been described as being naked when he left the Waffle House and having only wearing pants when he was sighted later Sunday morning.
So, Dave, what about the community around this Waffle House? Obviously a huge tragedy and a major shock. And then 36 hours or so, or at least a day of what I imagine would be just nerve-wracking terror while the alleged assailant is still at large. How are people feeling now?
Yeah, I think that the way that we've described it is that the community is kind of transitioning from, as you said, terror and nerves. You know, schools were placed on lockdown. Some parents kept their kids at home. People in the neighborhood of the Waffle House were told to kind of stay inside and lock their doors. And so now that this suspect has been captured, people are starting to transition into more of a grief mode. There are four people who were killed in the Waffle House, all of them in their 20s. And so people are starting to sort of move into, you know, coping with a local tragedy.
Dave, we're going to talk in just a minute about Travis Reinking's behavioral past, his apparent history with mental health troubles, and also about his guns and how his guns were taken away in the state of Illinois. Is anyone in Tennessee talking about why Travis Reinking still had guns or at least didn't have his past known to authorities once he came to Tennessee?
Absolutely. That is something that I think is probably the largest question that remains, apart from motive, of course, in this investigation. As news came out yesterday about how he got his weapons and how, as you noted, Illinois tried to take those weapons away, legislators and local law enforcement started to look at how he was allowed to have those weapons. Two congressmen here from Tennessee, two Democrats, along with Democrats in the state Senate, have proposed or called for legislation to close what they're calling a loophole that allowed someone to have weapons here in Tennessee, even though that person was barred from having weapons in another state. Now, this week is supposed to be the last week of the legislative session in Tennessee, so the chances of anything happening legislatively this year are pretty slim. But yes, there are lawmakers talking about closing what they're calling a loophole in state gun law.
Dave Boucher, investigative reporter for the Tennessean from Nashville. Dave, we appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Let's turn now to the question of how and why Travis Ryan King was able to have guns at all. Ryan King had a long history of troubling behaviors, and authorities in Illinois forced him to surrender his weapons after he was arrested for trespassing at the White House back in July. But under Illinois law, Travis Ryan King's father took custody of his son's firearms, and then, according to reports, gave them right back to his son. James Burnett is editorial director at The Trace, and he says with all the talk about gun ownership and safety, laws and procedures around gun surrender vary between the states and the federal government, and even between the states themselves. And that can throw up huge barriers to enforcement.
So the big picture here is that the federal law sets a bunch of standards, about 12 broad categories of persons who are prohibited from owning weapons. But there is no mechanism in federal law for removing guns who become prohibited after they legally acquire them. So that is left to the states. And there we fall into a patchwork of laws and systems. In Illinois, where Ryan King lived at the time, that's a state where you have to have a permit to own a gun in the first case. And as you were saying, after the incident at the White House, the FBI asked state authorities to revoke his permit, and they did. But under Illinois law, once your permit is revoked, you have the option to transfer your guns to a lawful owner. You don't have to turn them over to law enforcement. And there's versions of that elsewhere, too. Sometimes the state law will say you have to sell the gun and provide receipts. But generally speaking, there's no federal mechanism for law enforcement, for the government, to take guns from someone who has become prohibited after lawfully acquiring them.
So you're describing a situation where federal law enforcement authorities, the FBI in this case, even with the law on their side, say, we don't want this guy to have access to the guns that he owns, and then essentially has to ask his home state of Illinois if and how they can accomplish that.
Right. And in some ways, their hand is stronger in that he is in Illinois, right? So if you look at the gunman's history in this case, there is this history of erratic behavior, but none of it rises to the level that would prohibit him from gun ownership. And there's some indication that he was seen for psychiatric evaluation, but that was voluntary. He was not involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital. And that's the criteria. You have to be involuntarily admitted or otherwise adjudicated mentally unfit by a court or commission or other authority. So you can have this history of troubling behavior, but none of it rises to that level of the mental health prohibitor under federal law. And separately, even the incident at the White House where he is arrested on a misdemeanor for unlawful entry, he enters a restricted zone. He comes back to Illinois. He does his community service, and prosecutors dropped that case. It was a misdemeanor in any event. Under federal law, it's a misdemeanor that calls for 2 years of imprisonment or a felony. Those are the criteria. So that infraction itself probably doesn't prohibit him from gun ownership. So yes, federal authorities, what they can use and do use is they say, well, actually in Illinois, you have to have a permit. That's rare to own a gun in the first place. And we can use that mechanism. We can ask the state to revoke the permit. And then they do. But then we fall to the other side of the coin is, well, what happens to the guns themselves? Who takes custody? And again, in Illinois, there's a provision that allows you to transfer it to someone who has the permit. And in fact, you can live with the person who you transfer it to. There's no requirement that the person to whom the guns are transferred locks them up, keeps them safely stored. So there are gaps, obviously, in that relinquishment law. And the timeline here, I don't know that the timeline in this case has been nailed down definitively, but in some reports indicate that his father transferred the guns back to him after he moves to Tennessee, which does not require the permit to own the guns in the first place. And again, because his history doesn't rise to the level of prohibiting him from gun ownership, it seems he may be allowed to legally own those guns in Tennessee, even though he wasn't able to own them in Illinois.
Right. So let's talk about that interstate patchwork, because that seems really important here. I mean, you described Illinois, which has relatively strict rules and laws. You have to have a permit to own a gun. So the FBI was able to get Illinois authorities to remove Travis Ryan King's guns. He moves to Tennessee, another state where the laws are much more lax. And also, do Tennessee authorities even have any way of knowing that he had his gun privileges revoked in Illinois in the first place?
To my knowledge, they wouldn't have known that. And if you go back to the big picture, there is, by federal law, no federal registry, no list of gun owners and the guns they own. And by extension, there's no list of people who have had their gun ownership rights revoked because of some history of conduct or mental illness. And so there wouldn't be a way to know that.
Well, James, this entire incident and what we're talking about, the chain of custody, essentially, of Travis Ryan King's guns, has raised a conversation about red flag laws when it comes to firearms. What are red flag laws? How do they work?
So a red flag law allows law enforcement, or in some cases, family members in some states, to see that red flag and to petition a court to have a person's guns removed. And so there the mechanism is that the guns will be taken away, due process is then followed so that there's a subsequent hearing where the court decides that, in fact, that the red flag law, that the restraining order in this case was appropriate and the guns should be removed. And when you're subject to that restraining order, you can't own guns and you can't purchase new ones. And that's what red flags are meant to do, is to provide this mechanism for taking guns away from people who emerge as high risk in a very specific way, but have not committed the sort of offense that would prohibit them under the existing federal law.
Well, James, let's end back in Illinois where we began, where Travis Ryan King was living with his father, had his guns transferred to his father's custody. And now a lot of people are asking if Travis Ryan King's father might be subject to charges himself for those guns winding up right back in Travis's hands. Could he be?
Well, that is something that authorities are saying that they are looking into. And I think it's always important in any situation to not speculate as members of the media when we don't have all the facts of the case. But the law does say that you cannot transfer guns to someone who is not allowed to own those guns. And so that would be an illegal transfer if it happened within the state of Illinois. But it does seem it's possible that if it happened in Tennessee, that might be an exception. And so that's what I believe law investigators are going to be sorting out, is when did the transfer take place? Where did it take place? And did it violate this Illinois law, or did it fall under an exception?
A confusing and at times it seems haphazard patchwork of laws between the federal government, the states, when it comes to gun ownership and transfer. James Burnett, editorial director at The Trace. James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yemen is in its fourth year of a bloody civil war. More than 80% of the country is in need of humanitarian aid now. Meanwhile, a migrant crisis is overwhelming the coast. Many of those migrants are detained once they reach the shores of Yemen. And a recent report from Human Rights Watch claims that detainees at one center are subjected to horrific treatment, extortion, beatings, even rape. Isabel Young is a correspondent and producer for Vice News Tonight on HBO. She visited that detention center in Aden recently, just off the coast. Isabel, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Isabel, would you give us a sense of the scale of the migrant crisis in Yemen, just how many people are coming through that country and where they're coming from?
Yeah, so 87,000 migrants came last year alone from the Horn of Africa, so Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, etc. And those numbers have actually increased since the beginning of the war. The war has now entered its fourth year, and there's been a year-on-year rise, so the numbers are extraordinary.
Well, it's hard to imagine that many tens of thousands of people wanting to travel through a country that's already devastated by such a terrible war. And surely the migrants know what they're passing through when they attempt this journey.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised. I think that some of them do, and some of them have heard that Yemen is in a state of crisis. I mean, this is the worst and largest humanitarian crisis in the world right now. So that was one of the things that was completely astonishing and almost laughable, you know, when these people get here. Like, how do you think that here is a better opportunity and a better option than where you've come from? A lot of them didn't know. Some of them did know and were willing to risk it anyway because the situations that they were fleeing from were so horrific, or because they're so desperate. And, you know, when there's that light of hope and you think that there's a chance that you might be able to get a job and you might be able to send money back from Saudi Arabia, which is where most of them are aiming towards, then you risk it all in order to attempt to do that, I guess.
Now, Human Rights Watch, Isabel Jung, has generated a report basically detailing horrendous abuses, rape, torture, extortion at one particular detention center in Aden. You have visited this place. Can you first tell me what this place is like and what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, we were the only international crew to be able to get there. It was the most horrific conditions you can imagine. I've been to a lot of detention centers around Africa and elsewhere, and this is without doubt the worst that I've been to. It's prison-like conditions. I mean, there's no ventilation inside there. There was essentially a shed full of about 700 migrants squashed inside. We saw women in another center nearby where they were also kept in horrific conditions. A lot of them said that they didn't get the food or the resources that they needed or the medical attention that they needed. And worse than that, they did testify to horrendous human rights abuses as well.
You spoke with some of the detainees who were housed there. Can you tell me what they told you?
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult to actually get to talk to them because Mr. Khalid Alwani, the person running the detention center, was on our backs the whole time and was trying to ensure that we didn't get to talk to them. But when we did, they told us that they had daily torturings, daily beatings, that some of the boys were raped, some of the women were raped there, that they were extorted for large amounts of money. Some of them, Mr. Alwani would take them back to Djibouti and try and extort from them for money on the middle of the oceans. It was really horrifying to hear.
Now, is this coming from the detention center itself? Is there reason to believe that this is supported or backed or ordered by the government?
I mean, Yemen has just entered its fourth year of civil war, and the complete lack of governance, the breakdown of law and order there is really remarkable. And so I wouldn't suggest that the government itself is ordering the rape, the torture, the human trafficking that goes on in these detention centers. But I mean, they are directly accountable for them. And I think that they are massively under-resourced in order to address situations like this. And they are allowing them to continue.
But of course, this is in context of a much broader, horrible war and humanitarian crisis that we've been covering on this show. What is the situation right now in Yemen, in the broader war?
I mean, yeah, the war has been going on for over 3 years now. There are 22 million people in need of direct humanitarian aid. Over 10,000 civilians have been killed. This is ultimately a proxy war that's taking place between the Saudi-led coalition and the Iranian-backed Houthis, the rebel group there. And it's just grinding on and on. I mean, many of the front lines have been stagnant for a while now, and it seems like it is sadly just going to continue. And that's obviously leading to an outbreak of cholera and diphtheria that we've heard about in the news recently. And clearly the effect on civilians has been enormous.
Well, now that the word is out on this detention center and the abuses there, not only from your reporting, but wire services and Human Rights Watch, has there been any accountability?
There has been some accountability. Following the interview that we had with the interior minister, we informed him of some of our findings and we told him about what migrants had attested to. And he immediately dismissed the head of that particular detention center. We also heard that since our report was released, that there's been a warrant issued for his arrest, which is somewhat gratifying. And they've also said that they will be closing that particular detention center and opening a new one in the near future. Whether or not that's going to happen is another thing. But there does seem to have been a level of accountability. Again, we have to remember that this is a country that which is in complete meltdown, and that the infrastructure really doesn't exist, and that they are massively under-resourced to deal with the humanitarian crisis that they're facing, let alone the influx of these tens of thousands of migrants. So it's incredibly difficult for them.
Isabel, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been on a world PR makeover tour for his country, advertising that Saudi Arabia is modernizing in many ways. But this war in Yemen doesn't seem to be something that the world is demanding change on, does it?
No, I mean, it is shocking to me that there has been so little pressure and so little attention on it. I mean, it is the forgotten war, and rightfully so, there has been a huge amount of tension on Syria. I would say that also, I think that's somewhat to do with the fact that as soon as Trump mentions a country like Syria, then that's where our international attention is, and we've sort of only got enough space to think about one enormous civil war and one enormous humanitarian crisis in that same region at a time, sadly. And so Yemen has been somewhat on the back burner, and it doesn't seem like it's been a priority for anyone, really.
Isabel Young, correspondent and producer for Vice News Tonight on HBO. Isabel, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
The race is on in Wisconsin to fill the congressional seat of Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. Democrats were already clamoring to challenge Paul Ryan as they hope to ride this wave of reaction against President Trump in 2018. Yesterday, I spoke with iron worker Randy Bryce, who's attracted national attention and the money of national Democrats. Kathy Myers is also seeking her party's nomination in Wisconsin's first congressional district. Myers is a school teacher and a member of the school board in Paul Ryan's home town of Janesville.
To be perfectly honest, I don't think that Democrats have done as good of a job as they can or should to speak to people about our vision and how we can improve their lives.
I asked Kathy Myers how she planned to convince Republicans and independents to elect a Democrat to Congress in a district Paul Ryan held for 20 years and that Donald Trump won by 10 points.
The district is complex. It is indicative, I think, of the swing vote nature of Wisconsin. I believe that Paul Ryan was weak. The seat was winnable. People in the district were feeling that things like the tax plan and the health care plan that he proposed to replace the ACA, they felt as though he really wasn't concerned at all with the state of their lives.
Do you see this as purely an economic message, an economic race? A lot of people say 2018, people are going to sort of vote for or against Donald Trump in a way. But what about in your district? Is this an economic race for you?
Yes, I believe so. We have jobs in the first congressional district. The unemployment situation in Wisconsin as a whole has gotten better. But the problem is that wages have not kept up. That, I think, is a part of the economic message that we have to address. Not just jobs, but really good paying jobs and forward thinking jobs.
Now, Kathy, your opponent in this primary, Randy Bryce, has attracted quite a lot of attention from outside, of course, on social media and the rest of it. And a lot of Democrats on the outside think that maybe he's the answer to this Midwestern riddle, this riddle that confounded Democrats when they lost the Midwest and lost the election in 2016. Oh, he's a union iron worker in Wisconsin, the Midwest, and the rest of it.
Well, I think the phenomenon behind my primary opponent was about that desperation and about the desperation, not just of Democrats, but I will remind people that I'm a high school English teacher. I have 24 years of experience in the classroom. I am very middle class. I am of the background that is relatable to them. I know what their lives are like. And I would also add that I am a staunch union advocate. I have been elected to serve my peers as their union president and vice president. I have the bona fides. I've been elected to the Janesville School Board twice, and I was reelected in 2016, and I more than doubled my vote the second time that I ran.
Now, they're calling 2018 the year of the woman in politics, largely because there's a record number of women running for office at several levels, not just the congressional level. You see yourself as part of that? Is it important to you to try to put more congressional seats in the hands of women?
Absolutely. You know, the Women's March was incredibly inspiring to me. I've been involved in politics, obviously, before that. I have always felt that there needs to be a voice in government for everybody. I ran for Janesville School Board because of the union bashing Act 10 that Scott Walker passed. The voice of teachers, of the professionals in the building, was not being heard. And so that's why I ran. I believe that the voice of women is not being heard. And that's one of the reasons why I am running.
Kathy Myers, if you get to Congress, I think you already know this, there are a lot of Democrats in the Democratic base who are already clamoring for impeachment. And you might be asked to vote on that. Have you given that any thought? Are you going to be prepared to vote to impeach the president?
Well, I have given that a lot of thought, actually, and our campaign did a town hall on impeachment last fall, on the prospect of it and what does it take to impeach. We looked very specifically at the emoluments clause. I am not an attorney, but I am a citizen, and I care very deeply if people at the top, our president, thinks that they are above the law.
You said you've looked very specifically at the emoluments clause. That's the clause of the Constitution that says the president can't accept any emoluments, any payments from any foreign powers, any head of state of a foreign country. Do you feel like the president has already violated that part of the Constitution?
I do think that there is a case for that. The fact that he has not separated himself entirely from his business dealings, the fact that foreign entities are going to the Trump properties and using those facilities, I believe, in a way to gain favor, is a part of that as well. And I believe that public service is an honor and a privilege. When people violate those things, they should be held to task.
So, Kathy Myers, I think it's pretty safe to say that if you get into the general election against a Republican, that Republicans are going to do with you what they often do with Democrats in congressional races, tie you to Nancy Pelosi, somebody who's pretty unpopular among Republicans and independents. It's a good way to get Republicans to vote against you. Do you think that Nancy Pelosi is a liability for Democrats like you trying to flip seats from red to blue and win in a Republican district?
Well, I don't see that so much in my district. You always have to look to see what is important to the people that you serve. I know that they've tried to demonize her nationally, and for some people, that might be too inside baseball. Running and trying to meet everybody and to deal with all of the phone calls and everything else that you have to do. And plus, I am still working. I am still teaching. Nancy Pelosi has not been at the top of my list of things to concern myself with.
I understand. She is going to be at the top of your list if you get elected. Are you going to support her for speaker if Democrats win back the majority?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for Nancy Pelosi. I respect people in leadership, and I know how hard it is to be in leadership. But I also, you know, obviously, I think I have to keep an open mind about that.
Well, Paul Ryan has been representing you since 1998. What can you promise Paul Ryan if you come to represent him?
Well, we might disagree on things every so once in a while. A little understatement there. But, you know, I really believe that it's important to represent all the people. I'm on the Janesville School Board, which is a nonpartisan seat. And so I have served Republicans and Democrats. No matter what your party affiliation, people are looking for a leader and people are looking for a strong public servant, someone who will listen to them, someone who understands their lives. And I will do whatever I think is in the best interest. I will always try to work to improve the lives of the people in my district. That's how I've won in the past, and that's how I've served.
Kathy Myers is an English high school teacher, a member of the school board in Janesville, Wisconsin, and a candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District, where she's in the Democratic primary in August. Kathy Myers, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And if you missed my conversation with the other Democratic candidate in the Wisconsin 1st District, Randy Bryce, you can find it all at thetakeaway.org.
So if you're tired, we can sit down.
I'm not tired.
Oh, okay. I just couldn't tell because you were dragging your feet. Well, I just couldn't tell.
Why didn't you just say pick up your feet?
I didn't know if you were tired.
You were being passive aggressive.
No, I wasn't.
You are so infuriated.
Please stop yelling.
I'm not yelling.
That is actress Laurie Metcalf, along with Saoirse Ronan as her daughter in last year's coming-of-age comedy, Lady Bird. But you might know Laurie Metcalf better as Aunt Jackie on the newly revived sitcom Roseanne.
You kept saying what a disaster it would be if she got elected and how I wasn't seeing the big picture and how everything was rigged. And then I go into the booth and I voted for Jill Stein.
Laurie Metcalf talking politics there on Roseanne. She returned to her role as Jackie in the series revival this year. Laurie Metcalf is in the spotlight now. She's on millions of American TVs on Roseanne every week. She got her first Oscar nomination for her performance in Lady Bird, and now she's starring on Broadway in the Edward Albee play Three Tall Women. Laurie Metcalf joined me to reflect on all of it.
I've had a long career in front of a camera, you know, when you factor in that we did Roseanne for a decade, but I never got used to having that camera around in the room. And so without one and doing theater and having it be live and in the dark sort of, I feel more free on a stage.
Is there a great big difference? I mean, please instruct me. Roseanne, they always say before the episode, filmed before a live studio audience, and it's not quite the same thing as being on a stage in Broadway for three acts, but it's also not, you know, a movie where it's 3 seconds and cut.
Right. It's an odd little hybrid. Yeah. You do have the audience there for the energy that they bring. And it's really electric. I mean, you can really feel it because they want to be there. They're excited for, and there's a warm-up guy who's, you know, whipping them into a frenzy anyway before we even come out. And so they do add a lot to the taping of the show.
Well, the new version of the show, of course, opened a few weeks ago, premiered a few weeks ago to a lot of attention in America, both because of Roseanne herself and Twitter, but also, look, this is a show that's always thrived on the snappy insult. It is sort of the currency of the show. And the Trump era is just like the entire lens of that first episode, which I really enjoyed, is just Aunt Jackie, that's you, and Roseanne just having that conflict that so many houses in America are having, the Trump fight.
Yeah, they haven't spoken to each other in a year because of it, because of the election. But the writers dealt with it in a really smart way, I think, because we couldn't ignore it. But they took a giant, giant issue of the election and then ended up, like they used to back in the day, of boiling it down to making it still about the family. Hmm. So you get to the bottom of why this rift, a bigger reason why the rift has happened between them is their personal dynamic.
I mean, that's what the show always did so well, right? It sort of spoke this real American language, like the real conversations that people were having in their houses.
Yeah, and I think it's really crafted in a sense also that they're talking at each other and they can't hear each other.
Being away from you this past year proved to me that I make good decisions on my own. I miss the family, but I would rather be alone than let you bully me again.
Jackie, it is not my fault that I just happen to be a charismatic person who's always right about everything.
It just was, it was a slice of life that I think that they handled really well and built into the show perfectly.
You know, Laurie Metcalf, you like to give audiences something they don't expect. I want to veer over to Lady Bird for a moment, a movie that I just loved. And a lot of people coming out of that movie, my friends, were just blown away by your performance and doing something people haven't seen. I don't think you could have played that mom if you hadn't had three or is it four kids yourself?
I've got four and three have gone through the teenage years.
That's rehearsal right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I read the beautiful, beautiful screenplay by Greta Gerwig. When I read it, of course, I could identify with the headbutting going on between the mother and the daughter. But also she had such moments of tenderness in there, you know, little tiny shared things of whether they're having a Christmas morning together or they're going to look at houses on the market together. She very delicately laid in these moments to show us, you know, that their relationship that we're seeing right now, which is really at odds, was not always like that and will not always be like that. This is just the moment that we're seeing them.
I wish that you liked me.
Of course I love you.
But do you like me?
I want you to be the very best version of yourself that you can be.
What if this is the best version?
Exasperated, rocky, contentious, but they always do get back to that place of love in that family. I hate to say it, but like the Connors, no material advantages at all, except a lot of love holding them together.
Yeah. And because you sense that that's at the root of it, then you can say dreadful things to each other, but know that the heart is there and the concern and the care for each other is there.
Talk about Roseanne just for one more moment, Laurie Metcalf, not about the show itself, but about this moment in this country. You are helping to star on a show that is about this contentious American moment. Where do you think we're at right now in this country? And what has the Roseanne experience said to you about the way people, including the president himself, have reacted to it?
Oh, my. Well, I have to say that the show, despite, you know, that initial premiere show that we had, it's not political in a sense during the rest of the shows. except for the fact that we deal with current issues, you know, opioid addiction, job insecurity still for the Connors, ageism with their mom. So it is about current issues like it was back in the day also. But depending on where you stand politically, I don't know if you view the show through a different prism. I can't tell. I think that the show manages to straddle everybody because it really just does come down to the family dynamics. The Connors are dealing with their grandson who is like gender fluid, you know. So the Connors are learning, you know, and they're having to have dialogues with their kids who are doing things differently than the way that they were brought up in their house. So I think it tries to show people at least making an attempt to listen to each other.
Well, Lori, I know the whole show isn't about the election, but it got a lot of attention for starting off there. Did it bother you that the president reacted so positively, that he seemed to like what he sees, or at least he liked what he was hearing from Roseanne?
Well, he can like the show. That's a compliment. But I don't know that the ratings were due to him.
He seems to think that they were.
That's what I hear.
18 million viewers, and he was very happy to take some of the credit. Did that bother you?
Well, it's just not right. So, yeah, it does.
But it's not every sitcom. In fact, it's almost zero sitcoms that gain the attention of the commander-in-chief in that way and really get him personally invested in taking credit for it.
Yes, I guess. I mean, I don't know how to explain that reaction. Maybe there's a fascination with numbers, and when big numbers come in, then it's like dangling a shiny object, and you know he can look over that way and see.
Not big, Lori. Not big. Huge, huge number.
You know, I didn't realize the numbers really didn't mean anything to me because they weren't in perspective with anything else to me. So I thought, oh, that's a good number, and people were telling me, no, that's like triple good.
Well, it's a gigantic success, and America is really enjoying that show. Lori Metcalf, America has been enjoying your performances quite a lot this year, and you're back on Broadway with Three Tall Women by Edward Albee. Theatergoers in New York can see that. Lori Metcalf, Oscar-nominated actress and television actress, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Well, the president is sure excited about the Roseanne reboot. Are you watching?
This is Seth from Justin, Texas. I don't really support Trump or most of his antics, but that's life that we're in right now, and he's our president. So we do need TV shows that portray real life, and that's real life for us. The only way we get better is to see all sides of things and then let the best ideas and reasons survive.
You can always join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.